Romans chapter 1 and verse 17. For therein is revealed a righteousness of God from faith unto faith, as it is written, but the righteous shall live by faith. This morning we said that verse 16 and 17 deal with much of what Paul is going to talk about in this letter. It's really a summary of what he's got to talk about, and really the focal point of what he's got to talk about. And so after introducing himself, his topic, which is the Lord Jesus Christ and salvation, and saying, I'm talking to you saints, and he then would include us in the broader application of this book, this letter, he then says, you know, I've been praying for you. And I've been praying about some other things as well. I've been praying that I'll come to you and that I can share with you, that you can share with me. And then he comes to this aspect of unashamedness of the gospel of Jesus Christ. He has no shame for it. He is convinced of two things that we mentioned this morning. And what were the two things that particularly we stressed from his being unashamed? Good. What was the second then? What's the first? Charlie.
The gospel is free because it works.
Yeah, it works. It's the power of God unto salvation. So he, the Lord of the gospel, Christ, is sufficient for my salvation. Okay, what was the other thing? Yes.
It deals with the dilemma of how can a holy, righteous God deal with sinning man other than to
right.
Smash.
Good. How God can remain righteous, because Paul must have really struggled with some of these truths, and suddenly it was like on a big screen before him, it was as clear as can be. And as the Holy Spirit revealed him to him day by day, new truths from the Word, from the Lord, he was able to say, that's fantastic. It's rational. It makes sense. We can't understand all of it, but it makes sense. It fits together. God's plan of salvation is logical from his point of view. And so we need to see salvation from whose point of view? God's. From man's point of view, the cross is a stumbling block. It's an offense. Or if it's a stumbling block to the Jew, it's a what to the Greeks? Foolishness. And have you ever had opportunity to talk to somebody on an airplane or somewhere and they said, nah, go on. You mean you believe in that? Have you had opportunity and people have said that to you? You'll find it. More and more, as the days go by, you're going to find people say, you're a fool. You're a fool because you believe such stuff. But Paul says, I'm unashamed of the facts because I know the facts are true. And it's happened in my life. I've seen the salvation of Christ and I've experienced it. And now I understand more about God. So the second verse in this particular little phrase here of powerful statements, or powerful words, should I say, verse 17, for therein is revealed, in this gospel, is revealed a righteousness of God from faith unto faith. And we began to look at this word righteousness, or this word righteous. Can anybody like to give us what righteous means? Any thoughts you might have? It's a term that's going to reoccur a lot in this book, and perhaps you have some thoughts as to what righteous means or righteousness is. I know, obviously, you have very little time to look it up today, but yes, Kathy?
I think, to me, it kind of means right with God, being right with God.
Okay, good. That is one aspect of it, isn't it? To be righteous is to be right with God, in right standing with God. And we have this, actually, the same root word for justified or justification is the same word that the same root that we get righteousness from, and righteousness and righteous. All come from the same. Good, all right. To have right standing with God. That's to be righteous. All right, anything else? Yes, right?
Judgment.
All right, what do you mean, judgment?
Righteousness. God's judgment.
God's judgment, all right. And in what way will he judge? And why would you say it's his judgment?
Okay, he's righteous, so I guess he'll judge the unrighteous.
Okay, so it tells us something about his character. Good. It tells us something about his character. Anything else? Yes.
To be righteous demands a condition, and that's holiness to God. So for us to be righteous, we have to have the holiness of God.
All right. Another word that would be as good as righteousness is holiness. So the holiness of God and the righteousness of God are very alike. They, again, would come from the same roots. The holiness of God and the righteousness of God. Okay, Pat?
Blameless.
Right, blameless. Can you give me another word for blameless as well?
Without sin.
Without sin. All right. We can think of it in terms of God, who is upright, purity of life. All these are phrases which are amplifying for us what it means. Correctness in his thinking processes, correctness in his actions, correctness in his emotions, all his whole being, all is right, all is correct, all is blameless, all is perfect about him. This is, first of all, the characteristic we have of God, of his righteousness. And for somebody else who's righteous, it's one who is such as he ought to be. Because man was created how? In the likeness of God, wasn't he? You've heard that from the book of Genesis. He was created in the likeness of God, and therefore it is the condition of a man as he ought to be, righteous, holy. And therefore God was able to say to the children of Israel, be holy as I am holy. He said the same through Peter in his epistle. Be holy or be righteous like I am. Now God is going to show us through Paul's letter here that that provision is made, that the righteousness of God can be mine, that I can come into right standing with God, as Kathy mentioned. Let me read this to you, just jot it down earlier today. The characteristic and quality of a moral being that is acceptable to God, for God is upright, correct, perfect in himself, in all his thinking, and all his actions, and all his feelings. You don't have to write that down, it's just some thinking that we can put through our hearts and our minds. The characteristic and quality of a moral being that is acceptable to God. The character and quality of a moral being, and we're moral beings, we're persons, that is acceptable to God. And God wants to make us acceptable to himself. Now, those that we've just sort of talked about, a lot of words, and it won't be clear right away. Don't worry about it. We'll find it will come clear as we go through this text here. His righteousness, the correctness, uprightness of God, it's his very character, without sin, perfect, holy, all those words would be satisfactory. It says, for therein is revealed a righteousness of God. It's as if we said this morning, the veil is opened and we can see in and see the character of God, his holiness. And it's been revealed out of the gospel. Out of the gospel has come the righteousness of God. Now, in this particular verse, it is the righteousness which can be whose that he's referring to. To whom can this righteousness be given? Yes?
Jews and Gentiles.
Everyone who believes, all right? So when we say that the gospel reveals the righteousness of God, in our notes we've got that. The gospel, the righteousness of God revealed. We're talking about the righteousness that God is willing to give to everyone who believes. Because how can God accept you? What are the only conditions upon which God can accept you and have you for himself?
Faith
is the means, but what are the conditions? That I be, or the condition? That I be
without sin.
If I am righteous, am I not without sin? But you say, how can I be without sin?
Through Jesus Christ.
Right, through Jesus Christ. Now what does he do? He declares me righteous, and this is where we're going to come onto that word which we use a lot, but sometimes find hard to grasp, and is found in chapter 3, and we're coming to it. It's justification. How many people here are justified? Most of you. All of you should be, if you're Christians, okay? The word justified applies to all believers, because you have been declared to be righteous, and it is in that standing, in that state, that God can receive you. He can't accept us any other way except that we be righteous. All right? So, in this gospel, God not only has revealed his power, But he has revealed a righteousness which can be yours and which can be mine. Let's try and illustrate it by the Old Testament. Do you remember the tabernacle? It had that, and you'll come across it, it had that outside tent or wall. And then inside was this great inside tent. And covering it were all kinds of skins. And there were about 7 coverings. There was an altar outside, the brazen altar, upon which sacrifices were made. And then every year, what did the high priest have to do? The Day of Atonement. What did he have to do? Yes?
He went into the Holy of Holies and offered the people's sin and his own.
All right. He went into the Holy of Holies, but he had to do something first. He had to sacrifice a lamb. He sacrificed, and the blood, and this is a strange thing you'll come across, he put the blood on his ears and on his thumbs, and then he was washed with water. So the blood, as it were, covered his own sin, and the water then washed, as it were, the sin away. That's the picture we have for the New Testament. Look, Christ done. His blood covers me, then I'm washed how? Whiter than snow. So before God, the priest, before he could go in on behalf of the people, he had to be righteous or pure, right? So he was in right standing before God before he went in. Then he went in once a year into the Holy of Holies. No other person went in there. Now, why did he go in there? He went in on behalf of the other people. Why could he go into the presence of God? Because now he was clothed in righteousness. That's the picture we get. Okay? So, in the gospel of Jesus Christ, when I believe that Christ died for me, and that his blood was shed for me, I am accepting his blood so that it will cover me, that it will deal with my sin. And then I am allowed to come into the presence of God again, because God cannot accept sin. So he deals with it. That's briefly what we're going to get at as we go through the book. This righteousness then can be yours and can be mine. It is ours as Christians. It is our inheritance, righteousness that God gives. Now, how do I receive that righteousness from God? How do I receive that righteousness from God?
By faith.
By faith. And that's what it says here in verse 17. In this gospel is revealed a righteousness of God from faith unto faith. In other words, it takes faith to receive it, and it is only to those who have by faith received it. It's just as we said, the scope of the work of the gospel is for all men everywhere. But specifically, it is to those who believe. It is by faith unto faith. Then it tells us, and Paul quotes from a book in the Old Testament, Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 4. But the righteous shall live by faith, or the just shall live by faith. This is a text which is used a lot, isn't it? It appears 3 other times in the New Testament. Do you know where they appear? You can see it here on the earth. Does anybody know the other phrase or the other reference to the just shall live by faith? Habakkuk 2:4, then you'll find it in your margin probably, or Galatians 3:11 and Hebrews 10:38. All right, Hebrews 10:38. And each time you'll find a different emphasis on a different word. The just shall live by what? Faith. How do we become right before God or just before God? By faith. Now Paul is going to say, listen to me. Listen to me, you Jews. Please listen to me. The gospel of Jesus Christ can only be received by faith. You can only come into right relationship to God by faith. How are they trying to get into right relationship with God? Works, law, and as Jews, as line, I'm a Jew, therefore God ought to accept me. Or what's the other one? The big one that they, all males had to be circumcised. Right. So there had to be circumcision as far as the Jew was concerned. Paul says, hey, don't you understand that the gospel is a gift from God? The wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life. Can't you get into your thick skulls? This is what his message is going to say. Through the gospel, of which I am totally unashamed, because I know Christ can work salvation in my heart, and I know that it is the power of God, I know something else, that I can stand right before God. I can be right before my Maker. Now, I believe we'll be surprised, the hundreds and thousands of people who want to be right with God but don't know how to be right with God because they want to be right with God their way. There are hundreds of people who would long to be in relationship to God, but they don't know how. They don't know what it is all about. And so that's why there are thousands upon thousands, 40% of the population of this country goes to church. That's a lot of people in this country. How many is it? About 100 million? Why do they go? Oh, they go for all kinds of reasons. Some go because they really know the Lord. Some go because they think they want to get to know God, and you're supposed to do that to be moral and upright and get to heaven one day. Some do it because they're dragged by parents. There are all kinds of reasons, I realize, why people go. But there seems to be something that tells man he needs to have a relationship to God. And Paul says there's only one way. Oh, if only you'll understand. It's through Jesus Christ and this gospel. The just shall live by faith alone, nothing else. All right, we're going to Isper. All right. When it says in verse 17, God from faith unto faith, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay, there are different interpretations of that. And one interpretation is this, that you begin with faith and you go on in faith. It's faith unto faith unto faith, right? There's that aspect. But I think it's probably referring to what we mentioned this morning. The means of the gospel is faith. You know, as far as anybody who receives the gospel, it must be by faith. And the scope of it is by faith. In other words, it's for all by faith, and specifically, you must receive by faith. If that makes sense to you. Okay. Yes, Charlie?
So it would be faith to being born again? Then faith to righteousness, like in the
assistance. Well, that's one translation of it there. You receive by faith and you continue by faith, and it's always unto faith, by faith, right? And the second thing we're referring to is that when it says it's the means of faith, it has that's the only way any man can be saved as an individual. And then it is, the scope is that all must believe. In other words, you've got the two words referring to what we said before. Belief, which is by faith, and belief, faith in God. Right? So you've got the means, faith, and the scope. It's for all who believe. Right? The scope of the salvation is for everybody, and yet it must be specifically by faith for an individual. Right? Yes?
Yeah, I've seen it kind of for faith, to faith. In the sense of it's given to faith for that faith, you know, that's the, not that it's earned, but just faith is the only thing that can receive it.
All right. In other words, it obviously takes faith to receive it.
Yeah.
And faith is that which is, that comes from God. All right. It's a little difficult, and we'll leave it for there for the moment, all right? As it is written, and so he quotes from the Old Testament, the righteous shall live by faith. That it is by faith alone that anybody shall be declared righteous, shall be just, that the gospel will be theirs, and they are in right standing with God. All right. Learn those verses, if you would. Commit them to memory, and every now and then I'll say, all right, Kathy, would you give us Romans 1, 16, 17? Or Cindy, I need one Romans 1, 16, 17 today. So as we learn those, I'll be giving you other verses to learn. But let's make sure that we learn those two verses, for they'll be the basis or theme for the rest of the book. Now we come to chapter 1, verse 18. And we're considering these verses that take us to the end of the chapter. And I think you've written just a little bit for me, and we'll discuss it together. I know you're eager to talk, so we'll begin almost right away. Let's see, and I'll have to point to some because I don't know all your names yet. I want to get this will be a good opportunity getting to know your names. And what I'll do is, first of all, ask John over here. John, in just a few words, as you read through verses 18 to 32, what would you say is Paul getting at? Just in a very brief word, what is Paul getting at?
Death by rejecting God.
Right, death by rejecting God. Okay. Can you elaborate just a little more on that?
Well, he speaks of the sinful people and how they indulge in all the sins they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And God truly detests it and, you know, doesn't want anything to do with it.
Okay. Who is it who has rejected God and therefore received death? Who's rejected God?
The people.
Which people? Is he referring to the Romans here? It doesn't really say that it's the Romans, does it? He's starting from a point, isn't he, now? And what is the best thing to do if you're telling people that they need the gospel? Why should they know, why should they be told that they need the gospel? I mean, it's all very well Paul coming and saying this thing about the gospel and Jesus and righteousness, but what has man got to find out first? He's dead without God. Rejection of God brings death. Yes? The consequences of not having God. What are the consequences of not having God?
Death and eternal separation.
Okay, death and eternal separation. Actually, what is the definition of death? It is separation, isn't it? Death is separation of life. It's the missing of life. It's the lack of life. So death is separation from. Yes, Pam, isn't it? Sorry, what was your name at the back? Is it your name?
Kathy.
Should have known. Yes, Pam. Death is death and separation, the result of this problem of sin.
Also, he was speaking specifically to Gentiles, you know, in general. He's trying to point out to the Gentiles how really bad they are and how sinful they are and that they really aren't much.
Okay. All right. He's showing how bad, and I say Gentile, we'll say man is. Okay. What man has fallen to. Okay. Yes.
I was going to say he's treating them like Nathan treated David. He's telling them the story how it is where they can be objective and not on the defensive. And then just...
Yeah, does Paul like doing this? Oh, he says, I like to get a hold of these sinners and tell what they're like. Does he? Is that what he's getting at?
No.
He's not, is he? Because he knows what about himself. Just the same. But you know, he spends three chapters. And I don't like these first two chapters very much. You know why? In reading it, did you see anything about yourself at all? Just a little bit? Even if it's just a little bit, it's bad enough. And I'd love to just go past this chapter and get to 3, where it talks about faith and grace and redemption, all those fantastic words. But you know, that's our problem. We don't like to face up to the issue. Man has never liked and wanted to face up to the issue. What is the issue? Yeah.
Well, in verse 28 it says, they did not honor him as God or give thanks. I think that's the main reason why he's condemning them, because from there on it went downhill.
Sure did. You know what anthropologists say? That man is improving. Really. Man is, right, and evolution would all fit into the picture, wouldn't it? The man is actually getting better. He's climbing the scale. Is he climbing the scale according to Romans 1? No, what's happened? He's deteriorated. And actually, I'm not sure regression instead of progression. I'm not sure we're getting worse. If you look back and you'll come across some verses with Kathy in the book of Leviticus to tell us how far man had got. And if you were to read Leviticus 18, it's one of the saddest chapters that talked about the people who lived in the land of Canaan before Israel, the Jews, got there. In that chapter, it describes what's going on in this country today. I don't like necessarily talking about it. But look at, we might as well go there and just see some things that God warned the children of Israel about. See, he says, you're my chosen people. You are to be holy as I am holy. Leviticus chapter 18. Next week, you're going to have something of the story of how the children of Israel came out of Egypt, which pictures sin, and went into Canaan, which is the Christian life, right? And Bob Hobson's going to be with us, and then Kathy will go through it in some survey with the Old Testament, and you'll pick up the pieces, and you'll find as you're going through, things will click into place. But the story of Leviticus, or the book of Leviticus, is the giving of the law by Moses to the children of Israel. And the law that he gave was for a particular reason. What did the law tell the children of Israel about God? When God gave the law to the children of Israel, what did it tell them? Yes? It told them, A, they were sinful. B, he's righteous. And remember, God was on top of that mountain, and there was fire and thunder and clouds, rolling clouds, and God says, don't touch the mountain. Why did he say, don't touch the mountain? Because they were sinful, and he was sinless. He was perfect. And if they touched that which was perfect, they would die. God says, don't touch the mountain. Then he shared with them his character, in other words. From the law, we understand something of the character of God. He didn't just say, "Don't thou shalt not," just for the sake of telling them what to do. He said, "Thou shalt not, because I am God." And then he shared with them something more of his character. He says, "I'm not a murderer. I'm not an adulterer. I'm not a thief. I don't covet. And therefore, I expect of those who are my people not to do that either." In other words, you are to be righteous like me. So, since I'm not a murderer, since I'm not a thief, since I don't covet, since I don't commit adultery, I'm going to demand that of you, and I'm going to make it possible for that kind of life for you to live. So having revealed that, he says, you know what? You're going to go into a land which is full of all and every kind of abomination. I brought you out of Egypt, and in Egypt they worship the stars, they worship the cows, they worship astrology of all kinds of animals, fertility gods and goddesses. And I'm going to take you from that, and I'm going to take you out, and I'm going to take you through this wilderness, and then finally I'm going to take you into the land of Canaan. But you'll find Canaan just worse, actually, than Egypt. Canaan is a very beautiful land. It's a land flowing with milk and honey. But it's the people that make the place, isn't it? And it's the people who are in there you're going to have trouble with. In fact, for 400 years, I've been allowing them to go the way they've already chosen to go. And that's what we see in Romans chapter 1. The way they're going is ready for judgment. In fact, the land is now ready to vomit them out. It's sick to death of all that they're doing. And in Leviticus chapter 18, we find a description of this story and some of the things that were going on. And it's not very nice. Verse 1 of chapter 18, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, I am the Lord your God. After the doings of the land of Egypt, wherein you dwelt, shall ye not do." Don't do what the Egyptians did. "And after the doings of the land of Canaan, whither I bring you, shall ye not do." If they are not to live like the Egyptians and not to live like the Canaanites, how are they to live? Like God. I shall bring you into land, neither shall you walk in their statutes," that's verse 3, beginning verse 4, "mine ordinances shall you do, my statutes shall ye keep to walk there, and I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and mine ordinances, which if a man do, he shall live in them. I am the Lord. Verse 19. "Thou shalt not approach unto a woman to uncover her nakedness as long as she is impure by her uncleanness. Thou shalt not lie carnally with thy neighbor's wife to defile thyself with her. And thou shalt not give any of thy seed to make them pass through the fire to Molech." What does it mean to pass the seed through Molech?
Sacrifice.
Children. You mustn't sacrifice your children to the god Molech. That's what the people in the land of Canaan were doing. "Neither shalt thou profane the name of the Lord thy God. I am the Lord. Now, thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind." What in today's terms do we call that? Homosexuality. Thou shalt not, it says quite clearly to the children of Israel, you shall not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is an abomination. Thou shalt not lie with any beast to defile thyself therewith. What's he saying? Physical relationship between a man and an animal. Have you ever heard of such things? Thou shalt not lie with any beast to defile thyself therewith. Neither shall any woman stand before a beast to lie down thereto. It is confusion. What we're going to see in the book of Romans is that from the worship of God, when man sinned, he went into idolatry. Idolatry is the first step to, what do you think? Immorality. You'll find that this is a result of not having God as God. They have already substituted the true God for their own God. And what happens once you've done that is that you fall into the traps of immorality. And Satan is behind it. He longs for it. And he'll do all in his power to make sure man falls to his lowest. And he has done. It tells us in verse 24, defile not yourselves in any of these things. Now notice, for in all these, in all what? The things that we've read in the previous verses are all the things that the children of Canaan have been doing. For in all these the nations are defiled, which I cast out from before you, and the land is defiled. Therefore I do visit the iniquity there upon it, and the land vomiteth out her inhabitants. You therefore shall keep my statutes and mine ordinances, and shall not do any of these abominations, neither the home-born nor the stranger that sojourneth among you. For all these abominations have the men of the land done that were before you, and the land is defiled. That the land vomit not you out also when you defile it, as it vomited out the nations that was before you. For whosoever shall do any of these abominations, even the souls that do them shall be cut off from among their people. Therefore shall you keep my charge, that you practice not any of these abominable customs which were practiced before you, that you defile not yourselves therein. I am the Lord your God. Is it a nice picture? It's not, is it? But you know what? We're living in a world where that's happening. We're living in a world where that's happening today. Go back to the book of Romans and we see here how man got to that condition. And Paul is obviously laying the groundwork now to show how man is in tremendous and dire need of the gospel. He's desperate. He's hopeless and helpless. That's mankind. Mankind, apart from God, is finished. As far as God's concerned, yes, he's already under judgment and he's damned, because he'll have damned himself. So Paul is making quite clear, he says, don't you see what sin has done? Not just the sins you've committed, it's what you are is the problem. And what you are has caused the things that you've got into. All right, let's take verse 18. And maybe we can go to, let's see, who was in front of Kathy? I'm sorry, Pennsylvania. Janet. When it says in verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and righteousness of men, what does it mean? What is this wrath of God that's revealed?
The wrath of God is what we deserve.
Okay.
Separation from God.
Okay, it's what we deserve, right? That's true. What is this wrath, though?
Anger.
What anger have you seen on this earth? Have you ever seen anybody get angry? Okay, your dad. Now, so often, that's you. Did you deserve it? Yes. Pardon? So at the time, right. In actual fact, we know that to any of us, our fathers and mothers are to be the picture of God. And we are to be our children. That's why that does stand out to us. All right, you've seen your father get angry. He got angry because you did wrong, most likely, most of the time. Now, he's not perfect in his anger. But what do we know about man's anger? How does it compare with God's anger? Or what is the difference between man's anger and God's anger? Yes, Kathy?
I don't think we can really understand it because ours is so warped and so unlike God's holiness. We lose
really
control and all kinds of awful things when we're angry.
Right. You know, I'll get your comments in a minute. I think once you've had children, you begin to discover, and yet we wonder how, there can be so much child abuse. But this country is known for its child abuse, isn't it? Western countries anyway. For child beatings. Why? Because a child just will never behave himself. And you know, what does it produce in a parent? And I just have to confess, sometimes when Kyle does something wrong, the danger is that you can lose your temper. That's dangerous. That's not anger, the kind of anger that God's speaking about here. Now, the results of God's anger are terrible. And yet there's a difference between the anger that I can have towards my son and his anger. I can have a temper when I get angry with my son for not doing the right thing. Then he does it again. And, oh, you know how it's when you begin to grit your teeth and you get a bit hot behind here and your hair stands up on end. That's when you know it's not quite the right kind of anger. Yes, there's a big distinction between the anger of God and the anger of man, of mankind. It's possible for God to get angry without sinning. That's our problem. We have trouble getting angry without sinning. In other words, those emotions, those feelings that so often come into our anger are not there when God gets angry. And they're unworthy emotions that are associated with our anger, but with God's they're not. It's the wrath of God that comes from heaven. Now, along with the gospel, when God presents the gospel to the world, he says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. Does that mean to say that God is just going to say, well, I know you didn't mean to do it. I'll let you off this time. Come to Jesus. Have your sins forgiven. Can God just do that? What must God do? He must punish. That's why God can still be just. He has to punish sin. He has to deal with sin. So the anger of God was revealed at the same time as the love of God was revealed. On the cross, what happened? God showed his love and he showed his anger or his wrath. He showed his righteousness too. You see, when Christ died, it demonstrated his love for you and for me, but it also demonstrated his wrath upon sin. For where did he place his wrath? Where did he put his anger? On Christ. Christ became sin for us, and he killed him. He caused him to die. He paid the penalty for sin, and it was the anger of God. Now, when it says here in verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven, it also indicates to us that God is interested in the affairs of man. He's not just a God who has let things go and he's just sitting in heaven, twiddling his thumbs, waiting for us to shape up or waiting for the world to blow up, waiting for man to blow himself up. No, God is involved in the affairs of man. It's an anger or a wrath that is revealed from heaven. Against, now let's take somebody else, where or against what has this anger been revealed? And who's third up from Cindy at the back? I'm sorry, your name, let me get your name. Yes. Kathy, right. Kathy. I've got three of them sorted now. Kathy. Kathy, against what is this anger revealed? All right, what two words are used in verse 18? All right. Why do you think he uses these two words, ungodliness and then unrighteousness? First of all, what would you say is ungodliness? All right. They don't let him control them. If you're ungodly or godless, what are you not like? You're not like God, to put it simply. In other words, there's no God-likeness to them, is there? And ungodliness springs, as we know, from sinfulness. If you're sinful, you're not being godly. Right? Yes?
I thought we just discussed godliness was springing from God.
Right.
And in the last verse, verse 17, so ungodliness is not letting God be God.
Okay. Right. And if you're not letting God be God, you are sinful. Right. And which is in fact what you're saying, you are not like God. You're not acting like God. And if you're not acting like God, not living like God, and that's what he's going to show makes possible, you are living a sinful life. And that is produced by the word, the second word, Kathy, is unrighteousness. So if you are not godly, you can't be righteous. So if you are ungodly, you are unrighteous. So unrighteousness is the result of being ungodly. And the wrath of God has been revealed against that which is ungodly and unrighteous. Now, he could have just said his anger is revealed against mankind, couldn't he? But why didn't he? Yeah.
Because he is righteous and godly.
Okay, because he is righteous and because he is godly. But why didn't he just say the wrath of God is revealed against mankind? Yes. All right. So there's a little bit of a distinction here. God reveals his wrath against ungodliness and unrighteousness. That doesn't mean to say he's going to say, well, you didn't mean to do it. I'm just going to punish the sin. No, what will he do as far as the sin is concerned? Because he's involved with the ungodliness and because he's involved with the unrighteousness, what is God going to do? He's going to punish. He's going to judge. Now, this to the average person is very harsh. But why did he do it in the first place? Why did he create Satan? We go back all to those questions. We're going to see here that man is really, he is. He's without excuse. So God's wrath is revealed against these two characteristics, and they're characteristics of the man without God. Because the man without God is going to do that which is against God and unrighteous. All right, so in verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. Now, he does say of men. It's produced by man. Why does he say men? Well, man is the only moral creature that was made. Is God going to punish a dog and a cat? No, because even though they are affected by the fall of man, they're not the ones who chose to go against God. It's only man who chose to go against God. And so it says that this wrath is revealed against man because of his ungodliness and unrighteousness. And let's take somebody else now. The last part of verse 18 tells us something here, which is quite clear. If a man is ungodly and unrighteous, what is he going to do according to the end of verse 18? Let's take Susan.
He's going to push away the truth from himself.
Right.
They know that they're bad, so they don't really want to know what's right because it's convicting them.
All right. It says here that he will hinder the truth. What's another word for hinder the truth?
Suppress.
What's he going to try to do with the truth? Yeah, he's going to push it away. He's going to suppress the truth. When you hear the truth about yourself, and it's not very nice, what do you try to do?
Cover
up. If you've done something wrong, what do we always try to do with that? Make it... Yeah, we either try to accuse somebody else. Remember in the garden, what was the first thing that... Adam said? It was her. The woman gave me. What did she say? The serpent gave me. What are we so good at? Passing the buck and self-justification. If I do something wrong and it's pretty bad, what do I try to make it sound like? Two things. Either it's not my fault or it's really not that bad, is it? You know, you just don't make it quite as bad as it really is. And that's our tendency. That's the way we are because of sin. And when the truth comes along, and who is the truth? For instance, if the Lord Jesus Christ walked in the back door tonight, he walked down here and he stood by me, what would you notice? Him. If you could get your eyes off him just for a moment, and you look to me, what would you see? There's a little catch here.